the CBS News Weekend Roundup in 60 seconds.
For many of us, shaving is a pain. It's uncomfortable, causes nicks, cuts, and razor burn, not to mention how outrageously expensive razor blades are today. Enter Harry's, a company founded by two guys who wanted a better product without paying an arm and a leg to get it. Harry's makes high-quality, high-performing blades crafted by shaving experts. The founders liked the blades so much, they bought the factory in Germany. By doing this, they allow for factory direct pricing, a fraction of the drugstore prices. They will also ship for free to your front doorstep. The starter set is an amazing deal. For $15, you get a razor, moisturizing shaving cream, and three blades. On average, an everyday shaver saves $150 each year on blades using Harry's. Experience a clean, close, comfortable shave with Harry's. Go to harrys.com now, and Harry's will give you $5 off if you type in the coupon code 60MINUTES with your first purchase. That's HARRYS.com, and enter coupon code 60MINUTES at checkout for $5 off.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now from Washington, here's CBS News national correspondent Dan Rabin.
Who are the terrorists who vow to kill us? Are some of them American, British? Clearly, some are. We'll have the latest on that, including the ISIS executioner from the beheading videos, now identified. His friends claim he used to be nice and gentle. Later, Scott Walker, Chris Christie, Jeb Bush, Rand Paul, Ben Carson, Donald Trump, Carly Fiorina, and other Republicans who say they may run for president all spoke at the Conservative Political Activists Conference. You'll hear CBS's Nancy Cordes report.
There are few places besides a debate stage where you can find every single GOP hopeful.
There you go.
But CPAC is one of them.
Nearly all of them took at least a minute, by the way, to blast Hillary Clinton. They assume she'll be the Democrat running for the White House. Also coming up, an answer to peanut allergy. You'll hear one doctor advise.
Come in and get evaluated and get started on peanut protein if you're at high risk.
Peanut protein to fight the nut allergy. And a lot more news on this weekend roundup. But first, the man in the ISIS terrorist videos who threatened U.S., British, then Japanese hostages. Then he and perhaps others in ISIS cut off the heads of those innocent people who'd been kidnapped in Syria. That man now has a name. Details from CBS News reporter Larry Miller in London, who first reminds us of the man's nickname.
Jihadi John, always masked and dressed in black, was first seen in the video in which American journalist James Foley was executed, taunting the West in a British accent.
You're no longer fighting an insurgency. We are an Islamic army.
Jihadi John is identified as 27-year-old Mohammed Emwazi from West London, reportedly a college graduate from a well-off family. Known to British security, he was put on a terror watch list and ordered not to leave the UK. Yet Emwazi went to Syria in 2012, later joining the Islamic State.
On the process of identifying Emwazi, also in London, CBS's Mark Phillips.
His accent was the first hint.
This is James Wright Foley, an American citizen of your country.
For months, as ISIS romped across Syria and Iraq, British and American anti-terrorist officials were known to be aware of the masked figure's identity. But they refused to release it, presumably because they were trying to trace his links to other ISIS figures. Armed with a computer science degree from London's Westminster University, Emwazi was already on the security services' radar. When he flew, he said, for a safari vacation, from London to Tanzania in 2009. There he was stopped by British and local officials who accused him of trying to go to Somalia to join the Al-Shabaab militants. He was sent back to Amsterdam for more questioning before returning to London. Until 2012, when he disappeared and showed up with ISIS in Syria, where he became the man with the knife. Assam Karashi, of a group that deals with people under anti-terror surveillance, says he knew Emwazi and that he became radicalized because he was harassed.
He was such a beautiful young man. Really. You know, it's hard to imagine the trajectory.
the claim from friends of Mwazi and at least one civil rights group that the man became a violent radical because he was pressured so much by British authorities. We'll look at that claim in a few moments. In this country, the head of the FBI, James Comey, spoke on Wednesday about Americans who might answer, as he put it, the siren call of terrorist groups such as ISIS that use the internet to inspire people to commit violence.
That is a message that goes out to troubled souls everywhere, resonates with troubled souls, people seeking meaning in some horribly misguided way.
The FBI director was speaking to the National Association of Attorneys General.
I have homegrown violent extremist investigations in every single state.
The same day Comey spoke, Wednesday, federal authorities and the New York Police Department announced the arrest of three men who lived in Brooklyn, charged with plotting to join ISIS and or carry out an attack in America. The three are citizens of Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. According to the FBI, Muslims who violated the true tenets of their religion. CBS News correspondent Jeff Pagaz reported.
The FBI made one of the arrests at John F. Kennedy International Airport as Akror Saeed Kemetov was preparing to fly from New York to Turkey. According to court documents, he and Abdul Rasul Jurabov wanted to join ISIS. And if they couldn't get to Syria, the backup plan was an attack on American soil. Saeed Kemetov allegedly told an FBI informant, "I will just go and buy a machine gun, go out and shoot all the police." Jurabov came to the attention of the FBI last August when he posted a threat to the president on a militant website. "What I'm saying is to shoot Obama. That will strike fear in the hearts of infidels."
CBS's Jeff Pagaz. Let's turn to our analyst, Juan Zarate. So whether it's the three Brooklyn men or that Kuwaiti man from Britain, what does this tell us about recruiting by the so-called Islamic State?
The Islamic State is drawing from a vast swath of recruits to include well-educated, well-informed individuals who have opportunity. And in some ways, Mwazi, his identification, his background, does damage to what can often be a sloppy orthodoxy that the Islamic State is just drawing recruits from the impoverished and those who are dislocated. The reality is that this movement, like al-Qaeda, draws certain ideological adherents, many of whom are well-educated, many of whom come from wealthy backgrounds. Look at Osama bin Laden. Look at Ayman al-Zawahiri, the current leader of al-Qaeda, an Egyptian doctor. Terrorist movements often have at their core ideologues who are well-educated and who are driving the movement. Doesn't mean that there aren't other types of recruits, but the Mwazi identification really does give some more texture to the types of individuals that ISIS is drawing from the West.
Juan, how did you react to the claim that the man in England was radicalized because of too much pressure from police?
The contrary question should be asked, which is perhaps the security services should have done more to monitor his radicalization and perhaps to stop his travel to Syria.
ISIS, which releases a lot of videos, now is proud of one that shows its fighters smashing irreplaceable relics in a museum in Mosul, Iraq. CBS's Clarissa Ward tells us what's on the video.
A religious spokesman for the group condemned the treasures as sacrilegious. These idols and pagans for people in the past centuries were worshipped instead of Allah, he said. When Allah ordered to destroy and remove them, it was an easy matter.
This coming Monday, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will be here in Washington giving a speech to the pro-Israel lobby AIPAC. Then on Tuesday, his speech to Congress, which became controversial because he was invited by Republicans and the White House was not informed. The Israeli leader wants to warn against making a soft deal with Iran. Secretary of State John Kerry is actively negotiating restraints on Iran's nuclear program.
We've taken the risk of sitting down, of trying to figure out, is there a diplomatic path to solve this problem? I can't sit here today and tell you I know the answer to that.
The alternative, said Kerry, could involve the military. Up next, peanut allergies. Is there a solution?
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Revie.
It's estimated that 2 million Americans are allergic to peanuts. There's new evidence that if they were given peanut protein as little kids, they might not have developed that allergy. We have two reports, starting with CBS's Barry Bagnato.
It was challenging enough for Roxanne Palin's husband to deal with being allergic to peanuts, but then they had two kids with this dangerous allergy.
Having young having children that can't fend for themselves was scary and daunting.
She did what parents were told, avoid all exposures. Now, in a breakthrough New England Journal of Medicine study, British researchers safely reduced allergy development 81% by introducing peanut products to high-risk infants during the first 11 months of life. Pediatrician Hugh Sampson at New York's Mount Sinai Hospital.
This is really the first proof that getting these foods into the diet early is very important for the prevention of peanut allergy.
And it provides hope that similar strategies might be used to prevent other food allergies as well. Barry Bagnato, CBS News, Washington.
With more on the British kids who were studied, CBS News medical correspondent John LaPook.
Researchers followed more than 600 British babies 4 to 11 months old who were considered at high risk of developing peanut allergies because they had eczema or an egg allergy. One group avoided peanuts. The other ate a small amount of peanut protein every week. After 5 years, the kids eating peanuts had 81% fewer peanut allergies than the group that didn't eat them. That's exactly the opposite of guidelines from 15 years ago, withdrawn in 2008, that recommended excluding peanuts from the diets of infants and toddlers at high risk for allergy.
I think this should change clinical practice.
Dr. Hugh Sampson is an expert on pediatric allergies who is not involved in the trial.
I would encourage people with babies between 4 and 8 months of age to come in and get evaluated and get started on peanut protein if you're at high risk.
Meaning don't simply start giving peanut protein to kids who've had bad, even dangerous, reactions to nuts. We have to mention the weather. It's been a severe winter for most of the nation, unusually cold. CBS's Adriana Diaz this past Monday reported from Dallas.
A winter storm is pounding the south with rain, sleet, and snow. There are whiteout conditions in Oklahoma. By Monday afternoon, police in Oklahoma City stopped responding to collisions if there were no injuries. Icy conditions are making driving difficult in Dallas and dangerous in Amarillo, where a multi-vehicle pileup shut down I-40.
The upper Midwest and much of the Northeast coped again with temperatures in the single digits overnight and with wind chill even lower. Now, here in Washington, we kept hearing all week how the Department of Homeland Security would run out of money on Friday night. 200,000 employees considered vital for protecting the country, including TSA inspectors at airports, would have to work, but their paychecks would stop. 30,000 employees would be furloughed at home unpaid. President Obama's view of this as of Thursday afternoon, CBS News White House correspondent Pam Coulter.
White House spokesman Josh Earnest says there's no reason why the issue of Homeland Security funding shouldn't get resolved, but he blames Republicans who now control Congress for the impasse.
Here we are 7 or 8 weeks into their tenure, and they're on the precipice of falling down on the job. And that's notable when we're talking about something as important as funding the Department of Homeland Security.
Let's turn to the Capitol and CBS News congressional correspondent Stephen Portnoy. A week ago, the funding bill was stuck. It had been passed by Republicans, but it had provisions, Stephen, that would gut, practically cancel, key parts of President Obama's executive orders on immigration. But there was a solution proposed by the Republican majority leader in the Senate.
Mitch McConnell said, let's separate it. Let's do two bills, one that would keep the Department of Homeland Security fully funded through the remainder of the fiscal year, that's September 30th, and then have a standalone vote to respond directly to the president's executive actions on immigration.
But that did not go smoothly.
No, it did not. Although it was a bipartisan effort in the Senate, overwhelming support amongst both parties to fully fund the Department of Homeland Security. Still, in the House, leaders would not accept that. They wanted a three-week short-term stopgap measure that would avoid a shutdown but simply delay this debate over immigration.
Well, for more than a day, we'd hear House Speaker John Boehner refusing to promise that the House would do precisely what the Senate was doing. What do you think is his main motivation?
Well, Speaker Boehner has a tough test here. He's had to walk the line between seeing to it that conservative Republicans have their say. And as you know, Dan, conservative Republicans have wanted to say that the constitutional prerogatives of the legislative branch should carry the day, that conservatives want to use the power of the purse and tie the president's hands with respect to immigration. But on the other side, you have Republicans like Peter King, who said this week that it would be political suicide for Republicans to see to it that the Homeland Security Department would shut down. So Speaker Boehner's trying to walk that line, be a responsible member of the United States government at the highest levels, and also see to it that his most conservative members feel respected.
CBS News congressional correspondent Stephen Portnoy, welcome to CBS, and thanks, Stephen.
Thanks, Dan.
What did some of that arguing sound like? You may think someone was indicating to the news media, kiss my backside. Here's part of one of our daily features from CBS Radio News.
Eye on Washington. I'm Howard Arenstein.
When we make decisions, I'll let you know.
Blowing kisses in the air, Speaker John Boehner refused to say what the House will do about funding the Department of Homeland Security.
I don't know what the Senate can produce or what they can't produce. If they produce something, we'll decide what we're going to do after we see it.
Democrats stood firm, too. Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid said there's no reason for the House and Senate to negotiate.
It is a waste of time.
Thousands of conservative activists were at National Harbor in a Maryland suburb just outside Washington for the annual CPAC, the Conservative Political Activists Conference. They heard from around a dozen Republicans, including Donald Trump, who said they're seriously considering running for president. Jeb Bush spoke on Friday. Many at CPAC booed any mention of his name, believing that Jeb Bush is too moderate. CBS News correspondent Nancy Cordes filed this report on Thursday.
There are few places besides a debate stage where you can find every single GOP hopeful.
There you go.
But CPAC is one of them, an annual gathering of thousands of conservative leaders and activists. Texas Senator Ted Cruz is right at home here.
Obamacare is a train wreck. And that's actually not fair to train wrecks.
For New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, it's a chance to convince skeptics that he's further to the right than they think.
I'm pro-life. I ran as a pro-life candidate in 2009, unapologetically spoke at the pro-life rally on the steps of the State House, and vetoed Planned Parenthood funding 5 times out of the New Jersey budget.
Yeah.
Winning over this crowd is critical because they reflect the views of most GOP primary voters. In a recent CBS News poll, 65% of Republicans nationwide identified themselves as conservative, including a third who said they are very conservative.
That from CBS's Nancy Cordes, who says on Thursday, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker got the biggest, friendliest reception at CPAC. Up next, net neutrality approved. We'll explain.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The CBS News Weekend Roundup, after this short break.
Do you want to learn how to mask your identity to browse inappropriate websites and stream media while at the office?
Well, we can't help you with that. But among the many IT problems we solve, Barracuda's web security solutions keep online activity clean and ensure internet bandwidth performance. Reclaim your network, like 150,000 other businesses already have. To learn more about preventing web-based threats, visit barracuda.com/web.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Revie.
Net neutrality, the notion that no provider of internet content should be favored by being allowed to buy higher speed connections. New rules were approved Thursday by the Federal Communications Commission. The vote was 3-2. Support is not overwhelming. But a United Nations official in charge of freedom of speech issues is praising the FCC for net neutrality, what he calls a real victory for freedom of expression and access to information in the United States. Or is it, as conservatives are saying, too much government regulation? More from CBS News reporter Allison Keyes.
The crux of this much-anticipated rules change, says CNET's Maggie Bearden, is keeping the internet neutral and keeping big companies from blocking or slowing consumers' access to websites and apps.
You really need to have a watchdog in place.
But critics like Brent Scorup and George Mason say there are already watchdogs and...
The internet has not always been neutral.
He says the web already prioritizes certain traffic and the proposed rules are too heavy-handed. Cable and internet companies have argued no rules are needed. Allison Keyes, CBS News.
On another subject, the Department of Justice stirred up controversy again over the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, the 17-year-old African-American killed during a struggle with George Zimmerman. He was found not guilty of murder by a Florida jury, and now the Justice Department has declared there's not enough evidence to charge Zimmerman with civil rights violations or a hate crime. More from CBS News correspondent Michelle Miller covering reaction in Miami.
The news was delivered to Trayvon Martin's parents by prosecutors from the Department of Justice. The family's attorney, Benjamin Crump, was in the room.
How did the family take the news?
They were heartbroken, even though they expected that it was going to happen. It was just hard actually hearing it and knowing that the killer of your unarmed child was never going to be held criminally liable.
In a statement, the Justice Department said there was insufficient evidence to prove Zimmerman willfully caused bodily injury because of Martin's race, or that Zimmerman committed those acts in open defiance of the law. It is one of the highest standards of intent imposed by law.
That from CBS's Michelle Miller. Now what we might call a farewell interview with Attorney General Eric Holder. He plans to leave the Justice Department this coming week, assuming the full Senate confirms Loretta Lynch to be Holder's successor. The Lynch nomination was approved by the Senate Judiciary Committee. The vote was 12-8. Eric Holder was interviewed by CBS News law enforcement correspondent Jeff Pagaz, who asked if Holder believes there's too much focus on what he has said about race. The first black attorney general said America is a nation of cowards on this, too afraid to confront racial issues.
Are you concerned that as the first African-American attorney general that this will be your legacy, some controversial statements about race, some controversial statements about law enforcement and race?
You know, history will make its own determination, but I think my legacy will focus on the work that I've tried to lead on criminal justice reform, things I've done in the civil rights sphere, especially with regard to voting rights, the work we've done on LGBT rights as well, the way in which we have fought the national security struggle and done it in a way that's consistent with our values. I think those are the kinds of things that are going to define my time as Attorney General.
Do you feel a need to defend your record as you walk away?
I'm not sure I would say I feel the need to defend my record as much as try to make it the assessment of my record as accurate as it possibly can be.
So you think it's been misconstrued?
Sure. This notion that somehow or other this has been a politicized Justice Department, I think is totally inconsistent with the facts. One has to remember that I came into a Justice Department that had fired U.S. attorneys for political reasons, that had done hiring on the basis of political affiliation, that had excluded career people from decision-making for political reasons. That's the Justice Department that I inherited. I'm very proud of the work that we have done and also the way in which I have run this Justice Department over the last 6 years. So this notion that it's been politicized is totally, totally inconsistent with the facts.
Eric Holder, who will leave the job of Attorney General almost certainly this coming week. The Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Bob McDonald, a longtime corporate chief executive, ran into trouble for saying to a man he was chatting with that he, McDonald, had been a Special Forces soldier. Well, he was in the Army, but not Special Forces. So as CBS's Wyatt Andrews reports, McDonald humbly admitted a mistake.
That was wrong, and I have no excuse.
The secretary apologized for what was said during this encounter when he falsely told a homeless veteran in Los Angeles that he had served in the Special Forces. The comment was captured by CBS News last month.
What unit?
Special Forces.
Special Forces? What years? I was in Special Forces.
The secretary explained that when he saw the veteran, he was attempting to find common ground, but got it wrong.
And so what I was trying to do is find a way to connect with that veteran. And as I said, I made a misstatement. I apologize for that.
The next day, Wednesday, Wyatt Andrews reported the VA mishandled what would have been legitimate benefits to veterans in Oakland, California.
Five whistleblowers told CBS News that in the Oakland Regional Benefits Office of the VA, 13,000 informal claims for disability filed by veterans were stashed in a file cabinet and ignored until 2012, and that after 2012, pressure was put on a claims team to declare most of the 13,000 no action necessary. A special team was assigned to process the claims, but they found two important things. The first is that at least half of the veterans had died while waiting for their first response from the VA, and then the team faced pressure to declare most of the rest no action necessary, an order that essentially buried the file in the system.
Now to Southern California. A commuter train derailed in Oxnard, 60 miles west of Los Angeles, after hitting a truck that was stuck on the tracks. The truck driver was arrested, but by Friday he was released. Here's CBS News correspondent Omar Villafranca on the crash that injured 30 people this past Tuesday.
The explosion and flames lit up the sky after the Metrolink train struck the truck just before dawn. By daylight, you could see three of the five of the 7.5-ton rail cars toppled over like toys. The truck driver, a 54-year-old man from Arizona, got stuck on the tracks and jumped out when he saw the train coming. He was found walking about 2 miles away from the crash.
Omar Villafranca in Oxnard, California. Now a shock for a rural town, Tyrone, Missouri. 8 bodies found by police at several locations, and the murderer killed himself.
9 total victims here in this case, one of them being the shooter, the suspect in this, the other one being the elderly woman, and then 7 victims of gunshot wounds.
Jeff Kinder of the Missouri Highway Patrol, the elderly woman he mentioned, died of what's being called natural causes. The killer's body was found in a car. Please follow us on Twitter for the latest headlines at CBS Radio News, and I'm at Dan Raviv.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with the correspondents who cover the news. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Raviv.
Let's explore some issues suggested by the Academy Awards last Sunday night. The Oscars broadcast was longer than scheduled and not a hit in the TV ratings. On average, 36.6 million Americans were watching. That was down 16% from the year before. Who won the Oscars? CBS News correspondent Steve Futterman was there in Hollywood.
On Oscar night, a film about a down-and-out actor flew away with the top prize.
The Oscar goes to Birdman.
Birdman, starring Michael Keaton as a former star trying to make a comeback, won the Oscar for Best Picture. Birdman also won the Oscar for Best Director. Best Lead Actor went to the star of The Theory of Everything.
The Oscar goes to Eddie Redmayne.
Eddie Redmayne portrayed the acclaimed physicist Stephen Hawking and his battle with ALS.
This belongs to all of those people around the world battling ALS.
Best Actress was no surprise.
Julianne Moore still out.
As almost everyone expected, Julianne Moore won for her portrayal of an Alzheimer's patient in Still Alice.
I'm thrilled, actually, that we were able to hopefully shine a light on Alzheimer's disease.
In the supporting categories,
J.K. Simmons.
He won for his portrayal of an abusive music teacher in Whiplash.
Patricia Arquette, Boyhood.
She won for her role as a single mother in Boyhood, and as Arquette accepted the award, she talked about women's rights.
It's our time to have wage equality once and for all, and equal rights for women in the United States of America.
Best original song went to Glory from the film Selma. In the end, all 8 films nominated for Best Picture went home with at least 1 Oscar. I'm Steve Futterman in Hollywood.
Let's explore what Patricia Arquette said in her acceptance speech, Are Women Paid Less? CBS News correspondent Jerika Duncan did some research and interviews to find out.
I wanted to be able to control my own destiny. And
for most of her career, financial planner Maura Griffin says she was paid less than men who were doing the same job. So she launched her own firm to help women close that gap. Among full-time workers, women earn 18% less a week than men. Women CEOs, 20% less. In the legal profession, they take home 43% less than their male counterparts. Hollywood is pointing out that divide, where pay for women in arts and entertainment is 21% less. It's an uneven playing field from the start. A year after graduation, men are already earning 7% more than women, according to a study by the American Association of University Women. And once the salary is set, that gap widens over time. Anna Benninger is a director of research at Catalyst, a nonprofit that promotes more opportunities for women.
When you think about the impact that a gender wage gap has on someone's lifetime earnings, you know, with women being 4 out of 10 breadwinners these days, it's having a huge impact beyond just the women themselves. It's impacting our families and it's impacting our economy.
That from CBS's Jerika Duncan in New York. The Academy Award for Best Documentary went to Citizen 4, which is about Edward Snowden, an inside look at how he leaked secrets he obtained while doing contract work for the National Security Agency. This past October, I interviewed the director of Citizen 4, Laura Poitras. Well, were you trying to say in part that, look, he hasn't gone to prison? For Ed Snowden, he's found this happiness and it's turned out quite well.
Well, I mean, I still think he's made enormous sacrifices. I mean, he's had to unravel his life to reveal things that he felt that the public had a right to know, that the government, that we shouldn't be living in a country where the government is doing things completely in secret and has secret interpretations of laws.
A lot of your film, maybe most of it, that's the way it felt to a viewer, was inside a hotel room in Hong Kong where you could say Snowden was holed up with you, your camera, Glenn Greenwald. I know you're partnering now with Greenwald in a news site, The Intercept. So the feeling inside that hotel room, it sure seemed like you all were nervous, like, I don't know, you thought that U.S. agents might burst in. Was that the kind of feeling?
Yeah, it was really tense. We were there for, I filmed over the course of 8 days. We met on a Monday, and the following week he left and went underground. And yeah, it's a pretty intense encounter between, you know, Snowden sharing this information with journalists, and, you know, I was able to film everything that happened.
When you consider, you know, the sacrifices he made, as you put it, and the possibility of facing punishment or being arrested, do you think he made clear what he expected when he left Hawaii, when he met with journalists? What did he actually expect to happen to him?
No, I think he thought it was really uncertain. He didn't know what would happen. I think he was prepared for, you know, a whole range of potential consequences. And I think, you know, what motivated him, I mean, he's somebody who grew up on the Internet and believes the Internet is something that should be, you know, used for communication, and it should be free, and it shouldn't be something that surveils populations. And so, you know, he made that choice to take risks. And I think he didn't know what the outcome would be.
But when it comes to Snowden and the Internet, he's also always advising everybody now to use encryption. Don't let the government read all of our emails and listen to our phone calls. This feeling perhaps has spread to you. I mean, Laura Poitras, you live overseas. I understand you edited this film in Berlin. Have you become, well, what can I say, skittish or maybe even paranoid about the Internet and the government?
Actually, I wouldn't call myself paranoid at all. I mean, what we've seen in recent years is the government has really cracked down both on sources, whistleblowers, and journalists. So actually, I think that the government's been going after journalists and whistleblowers for years. And to use encryption, what I feel is to not use it would be irresponsible as a journalist right now. So yes, I use encryption. I don't think it means that I'm paranoid. And I also think that it, you know, that encryption is a tool that everyone can use. Everyone can be empowered to make sure that their, you know, communications are private, and I don't need to wait for policies to change in order to do that.
One other thing, in your view, everyone has to make their own decision, but if you are an investigative journalist and if you're dealing with some of these subjects, is it wise to live overseas? You're living in Germany, and Glenn Greenwald, your partner in The Intercept, lives in Brazil. You're apparently not afraid to come to America. Here you are. But is it wiser to live overseas?
For me, I went through about 6 years of being stopped every time I returned to the U.S. and having electronics confiscated. So actually, it became a question of source protection, so that I, you know, felt I could work without sort of risking the sources that I was working with. So that was the decision. And in terms of, I mean, I really know what I'm doing. Actually, I mean, I've worked with a lot of newsrooms while doing this reporting, and I can assure you that I'm, you know, very careful in the way that I, you know, do this reporting. And so I think that there aren't any risks in terms of working overseas.
My turn to be a little nosy at the end on your last arrival in the United States recently, still getting hassled at the airport?
Actually, I was not hassled. I stopped being detained at the airport in 2012. I went public with it. Glenn Greenwald actually wrote a story about it, which then caused the government to stop detaining me when I returned.
Laura Poitras, director of a new documentary. It's the inside story of Edward Snowden and the NSA secrets he leaked. The film is called Citizen 4. Laura Poitras, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, the U.S. and Cuba are negotiating for normal relations.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The CBS News Weekend Roundup, after this short break.
I'm Lex Friedman. I run my own business, so I know from experience, hiring new employees can be tough. Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 50-plus job sites, including social networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. And with ZipRecruiter's premium traffic boost, you can get up to 3 times more candidates. Quickly screen applicants, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 200,000 businesses. Right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. Plus, get 30% off your first traffic boost by going to ZipRecruiter.com/deal. That's ZipRecruiter.com/deal. One more time. To try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/deal.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Rabee.
We'll analyze in a few moments how the United States and Cuba are negotiating the end of their Cold War. But first, sad news on Friday that the actor Leonard Nimoy, famous from Star Trek, has died at his home in Bel Air, California. At age 83, he had pulmonary disease, which he blamed on cigarette smoking. Nimoy was a writer, a photographer, a filmmaker, and a thinker. But above all, he was a global star from portraying Mr. Spock on TV and in movies. Here's CBS's Sam Litzinger.
Leonard Nimoy's first autobiography was titled I Am Not Spock. He called his second memoir I Am Spock. The actor clearly recognized his fame was tied to that singular sci-fi character.
This is of great scientific importance, Captain. You're actually passing through ripples in time.
Mr. Spock, the half-human, half-Vulcan officer of the Starship Enterprise, so calm, so logical.
For this to do what it does is impossible by any science I understand.
Nimoy admitted to having a crisis about being identified with one role, but he would later say putting on those pointy ears made his day special.
Live long and prosper.
Sam Litzinger, CBS News.
At almost all ports on the West Coast, work has resumed after a long dispute between employers and labor unions representing port employees. But there is a big backlog, as CBS's Omar Villafranca reports, including paper to be recycled overseas.
700 tons of trash a day is sorted at San Francisco's Recology Recycling Center. It keeps coming in, but not going out. 1,000-pound paper bales are piled sky high. Spokesman Robert Reed says the mountain has moved into the parking lot.
Because we are having trouble shipping it, we're storing it. We're baling it, and then we're stacking the bales 5 high until we're able to then get them back on the ships and get that moving again.
The bales are sent to Asia and remade into everything from cereal boxes to stationery. Recycling is a $20 billion a year business in the U.S., employing nearly 140,000 workers.
A mess near the port of San Francisco. On Friday, U.S. and Cuban officials met at the State Department for a second round of talks aimed at normalizing relations. As CBS News foreign affairs analyst Pamela Falk, the decision to normalize was made by President Obama and the president of communist Cuba, Raul Castro, 2 months ago. Why doesn't it go smoothly, ending the economic embargo against Cuba and removing that country from a list of nations that support terrorism?
People should not have high expectations. Before the wall comes tumbling down, there are a lot of contentious issues. For now, this is just about changing the name of the Cuban interest section in Washington, D.C. to an embassy and the head to an ambassador, and changing the U.S. interest section in Havana to an embassy and the appointment of a U.S. ambassador, which here requires Senate approval. The trade embargo has not been lifted. needed. That will require the U.S. Congress. The Obama administration has opened the door pretty wide for some Americans to travel and telecom companies to do business. So the ball is now in the court of the Cubans, who are worried about what the deal will mean in terms of a real opening.
Do decades of official enmity make the process of negotiating something, you know, that diplomats and bureaucrats do all the time, is the process very difficult?
Well, yes, of course it is. Opening diplomatic relations alone is a big change, and they have to overcome 50-plus years of hostilities. The Cuban government itself is worried about things like the use of the internet by opponents of the government, and they are concerned about getting a piece of this big investment pie once trade is opened.
Now, does everybody know that U.S. diplomats in the future may try to undermine the Cuban system while Cuba may well continue to be opposed to all U.S. policies? In other words, you know, in world affairs, the two countries might have normalized relations, but they're not becoming best friends and allies, right?
No, not right away. The Cuban government knows that if a free internet comes to Cuba, their system of controlling everything will change. Today, most Cubans still rely on state-controlled media and little have access. It's hard to imagine for Americans, but they have little access to computers, cell phones, or the internet. Best friends, no, not anytime soon. The idea that the two countries are going to be friends all of a sudden, that is unlikely. On the U.S. side, there's overwhelming interest in traveling and investing in Cuba. Congressional delegations and businesses are flocking to Cuba. But the U.S. government has voiced its concern about human rights problems in Cuba, and the Cuban government was noticeably angry that the U.S. brought up human rights at the first round of talks.
Describing some of the problems, CBS News foreign affairs analyst Pamela Falk. Thank you, Pam.
Absolutely, Dan.
Now part of an interview done for 60 Minutes, but this is an extra portion that's not on TV this Sunday evening. Charlie Rose interviewed the comedy producer, writer, and actor Larry David. Thanks mainly to the worldwide hit series he produced, Seinfeld, Larry David is reputed to be worth $500 million. He hated it when Charlie Rose brought that up.
Why don't you like to talk that much about the money? Is it simply because you say they inflate the amount of money that you made?
The amount of money that I, the figures that I read about the amount of money that I have are so ridiculous, and it's absurd, and it's unseemly to have that.
Why is it unseemly?
First of all, I don't have it. Okay, I don't have that kind of money. My wife took half of it in the divorce.
Enough.
Okay,
fair enough.
And before she took half,
was that because you were generous?
No, that's the laws.
You mean you would have given her less?
Perhaps. I don't know. But no, after what I put her through, I wanted her to be happy. But
you,
anyway.
What you put her through?
Yeah.
What did you put her through?
Oh, it's not an easy job.
To be with you?
Yes.
Why?
Because I don't think of other people.
You don't?
No. But getting back to this money thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. I find it embarrassing.
How much money has Seinfeld in syndication made?
I don't know.
You must know the number.
No, I don't
well,
know.
Well, call your
number.
Accountant.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Well, look, I'm not complaining.
This is about accuracy.
I have a lot of money, but,
it's all
crazy. The figures are crazy, okay? Crazy.
It's more than $500 million. Dollars. It is more than $500 million.
Are you talking about me personally?
Yes.
Again, that's just nuts. No, it's not. It's not. And mind your own damn business.
Larry David now starring in a comedy play on Broadway. His interview by Charlie Rose is this Sunday on 60 Minutes. Thanks for being with us. And anytime you want to hear us, please do a web search for CBS Weekend Roundup. You'll find our podcasts also on iTunes and other podcast services. And our app for your smartphone is CBS Radio News. I'm Dan Revive. Bye.
You've been listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The program is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The executive producer is Howard Arenstein.